you. Thank you for that introduction. Is that good for the sound? It's interesting to think about the use of technology and the social context. I'm going to use some of you guys over here, so you better pay attention. I'm going to ask you some questions. You ready? Okay, now, when in school, typically the teacher stands up front and talks, and the kids all have to listen. So tell me, if you don't know how to do something on your phone, do you wait until the lesson comes in school? What do you do?
You go on Google Classrooms and email your teacher.
Wow. That's very good. Okay, how about when you need to know how to do something, when you want to learn something, what do you do? And she said, you Google your teacher. You go to Google Classrooms and email. Is that the only way you get information? How else do you get it?
You can raise your hand and...
Well, how about if you're right here and you don't know something about your phone?
Oh, you could ask.
But your teacher's not here.
Do
you ever ask? Do you guys? How many of you guys ask your friends about your phone, how to do stuff? Yeah, and I imagine you guys do too. Or, as we used to say with technology, if you don't understand what we're talking about, ask any third grader, right? Because they talk to their friends. It's a cultural issue, technology, and sometimes the youth culture, they're used to that. They I don't know how to do this. Show me how to do this, right? And then you show each other how to do things. The other day I'm the associate dean, so our assistant comes in the room and she felt real bad that she had to show me how to do something. And I thought, how silly was that? That she would feel, because I'm a higher status than she is. And she thought, well, I should know everything. But of course, that's not the world we live in anymore. We're leaving that world of where higher status or higher position doesn't mean that you particularly know more about things. I don't know if it ever did, but it does now. I want you to imagine a classroom that I was in the 90s, and when in this particular classroom there was a book that the teacher was using to teach social studies from, fifth grade book. She had it open. It was about the Soviet Union, and of course the Soviet Union became dissolved in what, 1989 or 1990, but the book that she had said the Soviet Union, and so she was going to continue on with that lesson, right? Even though there was no Soviet Union at the time. And so we're reading through it, and her particular, what I call participant structure, is that she has somebody read a page, she makes some comments about the page, and then she says, kids, do you have any comments? Oftentimes the kids wouldn't say anything because it's kind of high risk, right, to talk in the middle of the class. If you just say something, it opens yourself up for some ridicule, like, where is the Soviet Union? What is the Soviet Union? Why do we care about the Soviet Union? Those are important questions, but a kid doesn't want to raise their hand. But in small groups, in dyads, which is one-on-one, in pairs, they might be able to do that. So she got five computers, and it was my job to help her use those computers in the classroom. And I think one of the big problems with the reason why technology is not used so much in classrooms is because the structure of the classroom is kind of traditional. The teacher stands up in front. The teacher gives information. So we had to switch that around a little bit. So I said, well, okay, we don't want to waste the computers. We don't want them to be back in the back of the room all by themselves. So why don't we do this? We'll take two people to each computer, and they can each look up information on the computer, CD-ROMs and internet and so on. Okay, good. And the teacher was standing up, and she had a small group of kids that she was standing in front of, but then she felt uncomfortable because there were kids in the back doing other work, and it didn't seem somehow respectable. So what she did is she sat down, and I think that's a huge event. When she sits down, all of a sudden she relinquishes her authority as the person who gives out information. No longer is she the one and only knowledgeable one, but she allows the kids in the back to do their own. And then she realized, well, her group of 10 was really kind of big. And it actually was 20. She had 10 on computer, 20 she was sitting down with. So she split them up into two groups. One of the group decided to work on their text about the Soviet Union. And one group that, you know, she was talking with. And she became what we call a manager of information and no longer presenting information. So she shifted. So imagine the room. There's a group on the computers. There's a group gathering information with textbooks or with library books or CD-ROMs. And then there's a group that's sitting with the teacher. And then basically they rotated through the classroom every half an hour or so that each one got to be on one. The evolution of epistemology in the classroom, or for you kids, well, let's see if any of you, do you know what epistemology means? It just means what it is to know something. Epistemology means what it is to know. So how did you know things 100 years ago in school? Yeah, go ahead. You know what? Yeah, let me see. When would that be? 1916, 100 years ago, would there be books in schools? A few books. I guess McGuffey Reader was 1865. Let's say 200 years ago. How would you get to know information? Think of Little Schoolhouse. Go ahead. Okay, 200 years ago, you would probably have mostly just a teacher, right? The teacher would be there, and the teacher's job was to give information. So, was it helpful for kids to talk to each other? Not really that helpful, because they didn't have the information. They didn't know things. They couldn't investigate by themselves. So the classroom structure, which still exists today in most cases, is that the teacher stands up front and they talk and they give the information, and the students, they're discouraged from talking to each other and they just listen. Now, that was okay when we just had, the teacher was the source of knowledge. The teacher was the one who knew. That's it. So, when the chalkboard came, the teacher could put some information on the chalkboard. When books came in the classroom, mid-1800s and beyond, then, okay, now we can have kids reading books. So that changed the social structure a little bit. Then there were more books in the library, so we could get a lot of books. So not only when you all had the same textbook, you all had to read the same stuff. But when you have a library and you have enough books so that there are maybe 100 books about the Civil War, you can read about different things and then share it with each other. That was a form of technology. Now, obviously, the internet became a source of knowledge as well. So the internet changes everything, because all of a sudden, we don't have to have the teacher giving information. right? That doesn't make much sense. The technology, the internet, will allow us to get the information. The second part, introduction of personal knowledge, has occurred to some point when you write, when you have to show some knowledge, how do you normally turn in papers? What do they look like? What do they look like? Let's say history or English stuff. Okay? So when you give information, how do you give it to your teacher? How do you show your teacher you learned it? Maybe you can help them. Okay. So does your teacher want to hear the information that's in the book? Or does the teacher also want to hear what you think? Okay. So there's an epistemological switch. The teacher wants to know not only what's in the book, the canon, right, the official knowledge of school, but they also want to know more personal information from the child. And that's okay. The child can add that personal. Now, previously they could add it. When you write a report, do you get to choose your own font?
No.
No. Well, you know what? Well, there are times when you could choose your own font. Actually, we're going to talk about it in a little bit. You can choose your own format. So there's a lot of personal knowledge. For example, when you're writing about... What's the last paper you wrote?
Reading gives the key to my success.
Yeah. Reading what?
Reading is the key to my success.
And so what did you add to that paper from your personal knowledge? How is it different than other people's? Okay, but what was different than your other friends?
Some of my friends said that we
didn't. Okay. Yeah? They have different opinions about things, okay? So you added that and other people didn't. So you had a personal choice. Where did you get that information? Oh, okay. Thank you, yeah. Yeah. Okay. Give him the mic and we'll see. Where did he get his information from?
I got my information because I searched people who became successful because they read a lot of books, like Warren Buffett. Because he read a lot of books and he wanted to be an entrepreneur.
So there you go. He searched it on the internet, and of course that makes for a very different product. In other words, now Now what is the outcome, or what is the standard by which we judge the quality of papers? Well, a lot of it is personal preference. What is it that what personality did the child put into the paper, right? We don't want everyone to have the same paper. We don't want them to have the same summary about what makes success. We don't want them to copy the teacher's ideas and comments. We want it to be different. So personal knowledge is important. Also, group knowledge is important. So do you guys, when you talk, just raise your hand if this is true for you. Do you ask your friends about what they're going to answer on the report or what they're thinking about the report? Okay, so no longer is school just an individual event. It's also a group event. They ask each other. The way we do it maybe is to text each other or to Twitter or to see what reviews are on the web, right? So group knowledge is another development in epistemology that's becoming more popular today. What's happened is that the classroom structure sometimes changes, sometimes stays very traditional in nature. So, books are static, but technology is variable. We have the impersonal curriculum, the official curriculum, versus a technology that allows the information to be personal. Limited expression and talk in traditional classrooms versus technology that allows for a range of expression. In other words, now you guys are just writing with the 12-point font, right? But you could also not just write a report, you could write a brochure, or you could write a play, or you could write a movie script, right? Or you could write a newspaper article. So the format could be different because technology allows us to do that kind of writing. And then constantly changing software. That's the one that freaks me out all the time. I think everybody, doesn't it? Because, oh, we got something new coming, Vine is coming out, right? Well, my daughter Vines. I don't use Vine. I'd like to. I guess I'm going to have to because that's what she does. And my wife gets all the information and I don't. So I have to learn how to use that. But that's not enough. Facebook changes. You know, there are different and new stats in it. How many likes did we get? How many engaged people did we get? How many comments did we get? How deep were the... I mean, there's all that statistical information even in the increasingly sophisticated software that we have. One of the things that we did was templates. So, for example, we've got the Soviet Union text, the textbook, right? I just typed in the text on the computer, and then we'd send the kids to the computers, and we would say, you know what? I could ask you to just read this text, and it might not be so interesting, but more interesting might be if you were to take this and add your own information about the text. So one child writes, it says, the Soviet Union is a very large country. And the child is on the computer, has that template up. Do you understand what I mean? The text is on the computer that reflects the book, but the child's going to make a change. Well, there is no Soviet Union anymore, but what used to be the Soviet Union was a very large country, and then they search on the internet, and they find, okay, it broke into so many parts. They get a picture from the internet, they bring it down. So all of a sudden, that static knowledge becomes more changeable. That static knowledge becomes flexible. They correct incorrect statements. They put different fonts and text styles. Personal knowledge they put in it. I've never been to the Soviet Union. I don't know too much about the Soviet Union, but I have a friend here who I know, who has been in the Soviet Union, and I'm going to call him up right now. And so the kid gets his phone out, calls up, and Felix, and says, Felix, tell me about it. So you, again, using the technology, kind of group knowledge, right? It's not in a book, it's not on the internet, but you can use the phone to access it. Now, one of the challenging things to do in a classroom is kids have to be good at being social with each other, right? This is what typically what happens. Well, I can't go too close, can I? Well, let's say if you were to, why don't you give the microphone to the boy in front of you there, and then... Now, let's say you wanted to find out about the Soviet Union from Felix. Why don't you have a little bit of a conversation with him? You're dialing the number. Do. Go ahead. He's on the line.
Hey, Felix.
You say hello.
Hello.
Hey, Felix. Hey, Ben.
What would you like to know?
I would like to know about... I don't know.
Okay, so this is, thank you Felix, and thank you very much. So what's going on here? We have, hey man, right? And Felix is thinking, oh, hey man, I'm not sure if that's respectful or not, right? You want him to be, so what am I going to have to do with my students? I'm going to have to teach them the social skills, right? How do you talk to different groups? Now, typically older people, you speak to them with more respect, right? So it's, hello, Mr. Felix, right? Something like that. Very formalized, very, and that's one of the important things to do when you're in this new world of technology. You have to teach social skills. Let's say, instead of talking to Felix, he wanted to ask his friend about the computer or the telephone or something else. A lot of times kids are not very good at that. They're kind of brusque. They're kind of commanding. And they don't understand that you have to get to know the person. How are you doing? And you can speak their language. You can say, hey man, to your friend. You don't want to say it to an older person, right? So in any case, you have to teach people that kind of language. All right. So, social knowledge, choice of format. Now, commercial flyer, kids could write an ad, a comic, a play, a YouTube script, right? There's many things that kids can do nowadays that would be so much different, and that's because of what we call the affordances of technology. Technology affords you the ability to write a script and to edit and to add personal knowledge. All right. So here's an example of one kid, or what was in the text. If you look at the ocean from the shore or a boat, it looks like a huge mass of blue salty water. So one child writes, instead, they changed that template that I was telling you about. Thank you. It changes it to, my friend Lamar looked at the ocean from the shore and it looked like a big tub of blue salty water. So he changes it a little bit. Now what does that force the child to do? Then the child's actually reading the text and they care about the text because they have to edit it. They have to change it. They have to add personal information to it. They have to add, in this case, group information from the friend, and it becomes more real to them and more personal and more connected to them, if that makes sense. One of the things that has to happen is that kids have to become or have to learn how to treat each other as experts in the classroom. So what is the social structure in the classroom? Does the teacher allow the children to talk to each other? Sometimes, exactly. Okay. Sometimes it's mood, but sometimes it's different teachers too, right? Because there was a famous study done by Colleen Diut, and she looked at social structure as an independent variable, it was called. And what happened was she looked at two different teachers. One teacher that had two computers in the back, and she basically had continued on with a very traditional class. Teacher was teaching, students didn't really get to go back there. The other class, the teacher really didn't teach about the computer either, but she let the kids go back there and use it when they needed to. In that second classroom, the kids learned the computer really well, whereas in the first one, they didn't. So, kids were learning from each other. The teacher didn't really know about the technology. I'll never forget the time I was a first grade teacher and the kindergarten teacher came over to me and said, my computer's not working, what do I do? And so she said, I'll take your class, you go back and look at the computer. So I went over to the computer, it was an Apple IIe, right, on a cart, and the monitor was on the top, and I saw a wire hanging from the monitor just down toward the rug. Right? It wasn't connected. So I turned the computer around to the kids and I said, now what do you think is the problem? Well, it was obvious to everyone in the room that the cord that was just hanging should have been connected somewhere. And so the kids became the experts in the classroom. We have to develop that. How do experts act? Do they act pretentious? You don't want to lord that over. You want to be humble in your understanding and your expertise. You want to make sure that the person understands. You want to watch them do it. So in other words, what we're having to do is we're teaching the children the social act of teaching. No longer is it sufficient for children to learn, but children have to learn to teach each other. What are the social skills that go along with that? Everything that you think of as a good teacher, those are good things to teach the kids. And we usually do them in little mini lessons. 10 minutes, we set up a little situation, usually with kids, and we have a scenario where one kid says, you know, calls Mr. Felix and says, hey man, and then we say, let's talk about this. Is that appropriate? And if you, for example, in our situation here, he didn't really know what he was going to ask. Now that was my fault because I didn't prepare him. But normally I would teach him to have notes and have a number of questions. And what kids often do is they ask questions, but they don't listen to the answer. So you got to write down the answer. And when they don't understand something, they can't just say, okay. No, they've got to investigate. Ask further, more questions, right? Those are social skills that kids typically don't know that they have to learn in order to develop in the area of technology and even learning in other ways. So training student experts. I used to have my kids at recess. I would always have a group. I would say, we're going to learn this technology today. I'm going to teach three guys, and I teach them the technology, maybe two or three recesses. And then from that point on, I write up on the board that these three guys are experts on some piece of software, on YouTube, for example, or on embedding YouTube in something. I write that up, and then the other kids, if they need to do that, they don't ask the teacher. My time is limited, right? They go to the board and they say, oh, the experts on YouTube are these three guys, and they get that person and they take them over and they ask them how to teach the YouTube. So training of student experts is really important. Social skills and content. List of experts on the whiteboard or on the board somewhere. And then, of course, working in dyads. Because these kids are really good because they'll speak out loud in public. But a lot of kids, they don't, because they fear it's kind of high risk for them. Right. A lot of problems integrating technology into these participant structure is the way in which a person participates. Teachers tend to control class by having them pay attention to the same thing, and students bid for attention by raising hands. I think one of the reasons why we're not using technology so much is because the teacher does not teach the kids the social norms, the social language of how do you become an expert, how do you help somebody else. And the teacher is not willing to give up support. Certainly there are many other reasons. In some schools, teachers fear sitting down just because they're afraid of what will happen in the back of the class. But you know what? I think there's a lot of fear about that, and sometimes it's valid and sometimes it's not valid. All right. So that's one part of my talk. The other part, relational social media. We learn a lot on these and other new pieces of social media. Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. Teachers Connect. We have this, there's a new startup company that connects veteran teachers that are vetted, that are really good, with teachers who are very young. And there is this kind of like a LinkedIn connection that they have with each other. It's available to some universities, but also we at the university, we have to connect with people out in the community. How do we do that? Well, we do it, you know, through these social media sites. We give them information. Do any of you get all your news on Twitter? But you know, Instagram, you can get pictures, so that's some kind of information. But I think one of the challenges is that when I have a friend who's got, he's got his phone out all the time, and he's reading Twitter. The cool thing about that is he can orient the people he's following after just very specific areas. So for me, I would orient my Twitter towards higher education website or higher education tweets, right? All the Chronicle of Higher Ed, Inside Higher Ed. And so I'd get all that information. And it kind of makes me more of an expert in the area of higher education. Do you ever wonder about like the LA Times? I like to read newspapers, but you know what? More and more that I read it, the more I think it's like random facts. It's random information about things that the newspaper guy thinks is important. And I'm not sure it's the best for me. I get distracted and I read things that are really not going to advance my understanding of things or anyway. Do you ever feel about, I mean, that's how I feel. I'd like to know more when we get to the discussion section. Do you, like, you kind of think the newspaper is... Okay. Where do you get that from? Well, it's amazing how things are changing. We don't have cable TV. We just have the smart TV. So, whereas in the past, if you watch Sports Center, you had to watch all the stuff you didn't like, right? All the sports stuff you didn't like and all the stories you didn't care about. Now on the smart TVs, you just go, I just go to the Golden State Warriors and see what they're doing, right? And I just watch all the videos related to them. It's so different. Yes. Yes. Well, you certainly would be less broad if you didn't read the newspaper.
I said, I'm a newspaper reader also. And although, as my friend said, it's getting smaller and smaller. But I also listen to talk radio quite a bit. And there are all sorts of subjects that are discussed. Yeah. And different people come on and different ideas. And if you listen to the right one, you get both sides. And some you just get one side. You have to move around the dial. I also read magazines, news magazines, some of them. But a wide variety. When I get things on the internet, I check everything out. And some of it is years old.
Right.
You know, there's nothing I get for news on the internet that I don't check to see who sent it, why, and where.
Yeah.
Because some of it isn't valid, and then you get all sorts of things on the spectrum. See? But, and books. Books. Everybody should read books.
All right. Well, let me continue. Another method that we use to teach is just have the teacher continue to talk. Tell me if you guys have ever seen this in a class. So the teacher's up there talking, and then the teacher says, well, I'm going to pick these five people. You guys go in the back. You use the computers, and I want you to create, let's say we're studying about the revolution. I want you to create a newspaper from Benjamin Franklin while we're here doing other stuff. So you five people, beg your pardon? So they would go in the back, they would create a newspaper, and it's the same topic. At the end of the session, what happens is our kids know some stuff. We have the other kids the five who created the newspaper about Ben Franklin, they come up and share their information, and so we have amplified our information, and they were active learners. One of the things that we do, parallel construction. All right, parallel meetings. Obviously, when we're meeting, actually, I have a group of friends that we meet. It's called Tagua Fair Trade. It's a non-profit group. We sell things from third world countries where people can't get jobs, and we give them a fair wage, and they have to have health care and all that stuff. But all of us are over 60, right? But we all have, when we have the meeting, everybody's got their computer out, and we have a Google Docs, and as I'm talking about something, my friend over here is changing the agenda. And we can all see her change it at the same time, in real time. That's a different way of constructing things. Even, actually it's funny, one of my first papers, I wrote it and hadn't even met the person that I was writing with. But because of technology, I was able to write it together with her before I had even known what she looked like. But we sit around there in a group. Everybody's got their computer out. Sometimes in meetings. In fact, typically, I was at Fresno State 17 years. We would all have our computers out. And we would be listening and investigating. So, for example, I was at a conference called the American Association of Colleges of Teacher Education, and some guy is talking to me about a study that was really important. Well, of course, I went to the library virtually on my computer. I grabbed the article. I saved it, or I attached it to my email. I typed up, as I was listening, I typed up like a paragraph about what it was about. And I sent it to my faculty. I was in Las Vegas, and they were here at Dominguez Hills. So it's kind of as I'm meeting, I'm also producing things. And we would expect people do that, right? Do you guys fact check your teacher at all in school? No? She might yell at you? Well, it's actually a good thing to do, to fact check. Now, maybe one of the issues is sometimes kids, when they tell the teacher what was wrong, they don't do it respectfully. So teaching that language of excuse me, ma'am, right? If you say ma'am, she's gonna love you, right? No, she will. No. How about this? Try this. Oh, yes. You have to raise your hand. You have to wait to be called on. And you say, I beg your pardon, right? Something very formal. Well, like,
you say, hold on
or something. I'll wait patiently. You can say But anyway, the language used to object or to have a different point of view, that needs to be taught. And, you know, when I get up in front of groups, a lot of times, it's a little nerve-wracking because the people in the group, they know if I'm bullshitting them or not, right? Because they got their computer right there with them. All right. That was probably too rough of a language for this group. No. Let's take a look. All right. Let's take a look up here. I talked about that already. I also, how am I doing for time? 5 minutes, okay. One of the things, you guys might like this. One of the things we did, we studied the Romantic literature, 1830s around them, with Emerson, the name of this street, right? And there's a school named Emerson, isn't there? You went to Emerson, yes. There you go. Well, we read Emerson, we read Thoreau, and as a response, the kids tweeted each other information. So, in other words, the class was like number 405, English literature. So they would hashtag 405, and then, of course, they would have English literature, and then they would send that all to one place. I did this, this is one of my doctoral students. One of the challenges that some of my research is about is we get all this information at us, right? You guys get information, we get a lot of information, but we're not very good at judging the information, evaluating it, or identifying the implicit values that are in the information. There's also disinformation, lies my teacher told me, or about Columbus, for example. Critical literacy is what we use. TPAC is just a way of thinking that focuses, okay, we know how to teach something, we know the content, but we also have to know the technology. What can it afford me to do? So we have to, that's those three kinds of things. And then Twitter is the mode. Let me just skip over this. So you can see the technological information, pedagogical, and then the content knowledge. You have to consider all those things when you think of how to create a unit. These are the guys that we studied, Emerson and Thoreau. And here is the research study. So we asked, can Twitter, like the kids tweeting to each other, even during the lesson or after the lesson, you can get it on your phone. And the teacher actually, in this case, would have to teach you to use it. Some of you might already know how to use it, but others don't. But basically, as I'm talking, you could have a lot of thoughts going on in response to my idea. So you have my ideas, but then you're tweeting your friends, the whole class, what about an author that I know about here today, Walter Mosley. He's kind of like Emerson. So how can Twitter help? This was the school. It happened over a month, and basically, these are just data sources, but this is what the Twitter stream looked like. Good morning, happy Monday. There are some stories we're following today. That's not about Emerson, is it? That's Obama. So basically, critical literacy can be used to question authoritative figures. Obama threatens to veto. After golfing on California's water-guzzling courses, President Obama issued a veto threat against drought relief legislation in California. So you can use it. I mean, that was Washington Times. In any case, when we used Twitter, when we allowed kids to talk, kind of while we were talking in class, they were interacting with Twitter, that it increased their learning efficiency. In other words, they learned a lot more just because they were engaged. Twitter increased their learning outside of the classroom as well. So it was kind of like homework, but it was the kind of homework that you like because you're tweeting your friends, and that's fun. One of the things that kids loved was they loved to be able to use their phone in class. That was just a fun thing to do. Well, it wasn't a standing applause, but I'll take it. All right. One of the things it does, it equalizes the power relationship that exists between text and the child. So in other words, in the past, traditional classrooms, text was all powerful. It was the narrative. It is what we're going to talk about. But when we have the text, but people are tweeting at the same time, then the they have equal power to the narrative of the text. Yes. Well, the beautiful thing is, when they're tweeting those hashtags, you can see all the tweets and what they do. Now, they could switch to other things, but, you know, you do have to change your teaching and how you teach so that if kids get off task, they get penalized somehow. And they don't like to be penalized.
Excuse me. Now that everyone has an ocean of information at their fingertips, I think more than ever, people need to develop the skills for critical thinking.
Absolutely.
That is, read between the lines.
Yes.
Because there's so much of it out there, you can't just pick and choose, well, I like this or I don't like that. You have to be able to... I learned that early on. That's a long story I won't go into, but it's something I use today, and I'm exposed to the same ocean of information all of you are, so you have to, learn to be discriminate in what you pick on, because you'll drown. It's in the ocean.
Yeah.
But you have to be able to pick it apart.
Yeah.
And I think that's becoming overwhelmed with this ocean of information today, and that's to our detriment.
That is so true. That I mean, and that's why I wrote the book, the Critical Literacy book. It's a lot about understanding bias, identifying the values that are... If you watch a TV show, right, and you look at the values that are implicit in each, well, in different TV shows, you see what their bias is. You see what they're pushing. Why are they doing this? Why do they have those words or these scenes or those pictures? What are they pushing? And you can identify bias, but that's... usually we think of who's favored, who's marginalized, or what ideas are favored, which ideas are marginalized. A lot of movies are actually... all the movies would shoot 'em up, you know, the vigilante, Batman, Superman, that kind of thing. You would go to jail if you were Batman or Superman. You can't just go out and shoot people or beat people up, right? The police have to do it, right? But you have to think about that a little bit. And critical thinking is an important part of that. Thank you for mentioning it. So these are some things that we learned in using Twitter. It increased the quantity of interaction between the kids. And what we know is that when kids are talking to each other about the topic, they're learning, right? And when we use Twitter, they were doing more of that interaction with each other. Kids wrote, using Twitter as a learning process is going to be helpful, fun and helpful. It prompted students to use different syntax, vocabulary, at least slightly different meaning to communicate. Now everybody... One of the things that happens is knowledge is out there. How does it become part of you? How does it become part of what you believe? Or how does it become something you're against? You only get it through social interaction. And so Twitter, the requirement of tweeting things to other people, and of course Twitter is just one. It could have been email or Google Classroom or could have been a discussion board. Twitter is one of the ways you communicate. It helps you with that different syntax and vocabulary. So all of a sudden, kids were using words that were much larger on Twitter. It facilitated publication with their peer group. It promoted equity in student voice. We were able to hear those who were less outspoken. That's what one kid said. In other words, there are kids in the class that didn't talk very much, but since they all had to tweet, then there was more participation. We were talking back here a little bit about how some people, they're very quiet in class, but their minds are going like crazy. And you don't see that except if you have a discussion board where they're able to, where they're expected, not even able, where they're expected to post their ideas. All right. One student participated more on Twitter than she had on any other class. So, Twitter was used as a platform to facilitate the application of critical literacy, critical thinking, we could say, finding information, applying critical literacy, and communicating. So one student said, applying critical literacy, critical thinking, really gave us new perspectives on typical ideas. Now, in critical literacy, one of the things we have to do is you have to challenge the text. In other words, let's say the text says, well, at Porter Ranch, the gas is really terrible for your health. Okay, let's say that's what the newspaper says. As critical literacy, what you do in order to investigate the other perspective, another perspective, is say, you know what? It's not really that bad. Let's find information that would come from another point of view and see if there's anything there. And let's try on the clothes of a different point of view, a different perspective. I found it was easier to do the efferent. Efferent is information. The aesthetic, the beauty of the language, and the critical stance on the chart. Well, that's a big language for students. Because I got a better understanding of the text because the kids were tweeting things out. So more active participation, more relationship building because they were texting each other and they were connecting with each other socially. A democratization of the classroom, in other words, lots of ideas as opposed to just one or two, well, the only perspective in the text, whatever the text says. Democratization is many voices, right? Many points of view. Well, yeah, I mean, certainly you would have to say no spitballs, right? And you'd still have to punish kids that throw spitballs. But I think it distracts them and helps them focus a little bit more on the ideas of the text because they get to participate. Sometimes when they're throwing spitballs, it's because they're thinking, I don't really care about this. But if you say, no, you have to tweet about ideas every 10 minutes, then the kids, all of a sudden, they're thinking, okay, what am I going to tweet? What am I going to tweet? And then they're thinking and they're composing. So that takes up the time that they would normally sit there and say, I'm bored, I hate this, doesn't relate to me. What you need to do is establish norms and procedures first, right? So what kind of language, or first of all, how do you do it? And you talk for 10 minutes about how you do it. Then you practice doing it, maybe with content, actually whatever you're happening to learn, for the next hour. So you learn about the skill, the technological skill, and then you learn about the social skill that goes along with it, what words to use, what words not to use, and how to stay on topic. And then you learn the content. You use the content. So little mini lesson, working in the content with that medium, if it's Twitter or Google Classrooms or whatever, it could be Facebook or YouTube or whatever. So using that, and then as you're watching the kids, you will notice that there are going to be problems, right? Maybe kids are mean to each other, or maybe they say a bad word, or maybe they're not interacting. And so you think of, okay, what's a little mini lesson, a 10-minute lesson that I can give to my students now that would address that problem? And so you provide that. So think of the norms. I mean, typically that's kind of it's good to think of those norms in advance, what you expect, and have these little 10-minute things. And then, of course, you have to do them not once. You got to do every Monday or Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, so they become ingrained habits and go slow. And then little by little, You begin to transform their world. This is a precious thing. You begin to change who they are, how they interact with each other, and they begin to have those tools where they fit into society more. Common Core is all about bias. And one of the things that we did here is we explored different biases. And we actually required children to express themselves in ways that they didn't maybe believe in. To take a different perspective. Not because they believed in it, but because they wanted to try out something else. So, for example, the American Revolution, not such a good idea, actually. American Revolution wasn't good. You know what? Canada didn't have one. New Zealand, South Africa, Australia. You know, so you may not believe that, but you try it out. And you really try to argue the other side. I don't know if you've ever been in a political argument with somebody and somebody's arguing away at their side and it's not the point of view that you would give, but you listen to them and then you think, you know what? Your argument could be better. And then you tell them how their argument could be better, even though it's not your point of view. Right? Your best argument is to say this. I'm sure we all do that. So, active participation, relationship building, democratization, formative assessment. So, formative just means whatever the kids do, that we don't, let's say they were to say, hey man, hey Felix, right? Then we say, no, that's what you have to say is something respectful to Mr. Felix. You have to speak in a respectful way. You have to speak slowly because they're not in the fast speak world. So formative just means it's not like I'm saying, he says, hey man, I say, well, you get a D for that. How is that helpful? Formative feedback is, I'm going to help you become better. I'm going to help you form to become a better and different person. And that's the kind of feedback that we're looking for. Certainly that's Common Core too. But Common Core is into the bias and perspective and the point of view and of course evidence-based stuff. So that's all part of this. All right, I think that is some of the main ideas about what I talked about today is relieving the cognitive burden. I know that it's kind of complicated and ambiguous, but when technology can be used to take the information out of your head and get it on the paper and then if you write it out, it's actually much more articulate and complex than it would be if you just spoke it. Does that make sense? So in other words, you can't possibly speak with such complexity and everything following each other, all the supporting points, but in writing, not just using Twitter, but other things like scripts and so on, technology relieves that burden of having to remember everything in your head. You engage the learner. The learner is much more active. Technology affords you the opportunity, the child the opportunity, to be more personal, to give their personal opinion, like we said about Soviet Union, right? It's a country, my friend has been there, my friend Felix has been there. He says they had a famine in 1930. I didn't know anything about that. So he adds that to the text. That's active, but it's also personal because he knows Felix. Authentic learner means you just learn about things that you otherwise would normally have learned about if you weren't in school. Things that are helpful in life. Social learner. Kids love to be social. You can tell that, right? They love to talk to each other, and it's a wonderful thing. This allows them to use that strength that they have, that that drive that they have to be social, to talk to each other. It allows them to do that and engage in the topic. Critical learner, and of course the teacher's role shifts. The teacher's no longer the person up front giving the information. What the teacher says is, this is how you start an email. This is, you always say thanks. You always say please. You address people who are older with more respect. I mean, all those things, the social things, the technological things is what the teacher teaches. They don't teach content anymore. The kids can get the content using the technology. Thank you very much. Yeah. EJ.
Thank you. I've heard it said, in fact, I remember a English teacher at a two-year school mentioning that her comment was, my students don't read.
Yeah.
By don't read, I don't mean they can't read. She says they eschew reading in any depth, like a lot of bits and pieces and tweets and things, but chapters and sections, reading the whole thing, digesting it, go back and rereading part of it to understand it better, cogitating on it.
Right.
That's, I've heard it said more than once, that's becoming damn near lost art.
Well, not in college. When they get to college, they actually, it's amazing. When I look at what I did in college in my senior year, and then I look at what I demand my students to do, I think my students currently write at least 10 times more than I wrote. I remember a 14-page paper. It was my senior project. I wrote it in Spanish, but still it was my senior paper, and I thought that was a long paper. 14 pages today is not even that long, right, for kids. I in typical class, I have them write 100 or so pages of information, and they read more than that. But like you say, they don't read every word, right? They read the parts that will help them understand. But I agree with you. I agree with you because kids need to learn to focus, to calm down, to learn what's on the page, to be deliberate in their thinking, to slow, actually, I would say slow down their reading. They need to spend more time in text and kind of figuring things out by themselves. I mean, I'm a literacy person, so we talk about Twitter, but it's based on having read Emerson and Thoreau. So they really have to spend time thinking about it.
They should move from tweets to the daily newspaper, and from the daily newspaper, hopefully something like the Wall Street Journal,
where
you have lengthy, in-depth articles with a lot of supporting information, and the reporter has done their homework, and you can really cogitate over that and discuss it with other people. Even if you don't, you talk about taking different points of view. I don't know if they still have this in school. They used to have debating squads where you'd have to take you'd be assigned a point of view. It may be diametrically opposed to your own personal.
Yes.
You have to have a fully fleshed argument as to support that. You have to swallow and just do that.
Right.
Do they still have debating squads?
Yes, they do. I don't know how common they are. Do you guys know what debate team? Well, you're probably too young for a debate team. Debate's more of a high school thing. They do. They have speaking contests, and debate is one of the forms of speaking, and they do have debate teams. I just don't know how common they are. Well, there is, of course, in a discussion, you're just kind of exposing yourself and you're just kind of going with the spirit, right? But then there comes a point to where you don't really know if you've got depth, and it's good to write some of that stuff down, because you know, a lot of kids, if they were to write down what they say and then look at it, they would think, oh, not very rigorous, not very complex, right? And I mean, I do that all the time. I look at what I've written. So it's good to write things. And like, I like the long narratives because those are the things that I remember. Those are the things that are most impressive.
These lengthy papers that students are turning in. Is it all original stuff they're drafting, or are they picking up a lot of stuff?
Cutting
and pasting.
That's one of the skills that we have to teach them, right? That's one of the very things. What can you cut and paste, and who do you have to cite? Or do you have to rephrase things? Or to what degree do you need to use your own words? Or do you need to restructure the argument? Or otherwise, it's just copy. You know, I had an article. I read an article once, and I'm reading along. I thought, oh, this is great stuff. And I'm reading, it's wonderful. Boy, it's exactly, and I realized, basically had copied my ideas from one of my previous articles and just rewrote it in their own words. Well, that's copying too, right? Someone needs to purchase, or somebody needs to use them, yeah. Well, there is this movement called BYOD, Bring Your Own Device, and that works for some schools. Some kids would prefer to use their own. Other kids, of course, they can't afford it, or their parents don't believe that they can be responsible enough with it. So the school can buy them. But they're so cheap nowadays that I think it's a school would be negligent not to have a lot of technology. We pay, as taxpayers, probably around, well, in Fresno, I'll tell you, there was 72,000 kids, 950 million dollar budget, just divided out, you know. It was $13,000 per kid per year. So, and Fresno is a poor area. It's everything, right. It's everything, but when I thought about, okay, let's say I'm a teacher, I get, well, $13,000 times 30 kids, that's $390,000. Okay, you pay a teacher $90,000, that would be a pretty good wage for them, including benefits. So then you got $300,000 left over. The taxpayer should be saying, whoa, where is my money going, right? Where is my money going? Because $300,000, is that like administrator salary? I don't think so. And so certainly a high priority should be placed on buying the technology. Certainly they can afford that. It's hundreds of dollars. They got $13,000 per kid per year.
I just wanted to address your question. Students don't read as much as they used to, and they don't read as much as they should. So being a literacy person in secondary and an English teacher, one thing I stressed to my kids last year because of that and because of the millennial generation with the phone and the texting and not wanting to write are the novels and books on Audible. So when I would assign a novel, I made sure it was one that they could have free access to and download it on the phone.
Yeah.
And read and listen,
yeah.
Because there are different levels of kids in the classroom, and there are a handful that still like to read. But you have the other percentage that don't. So that Audible helps with that student that doesn't like to read. Then you got to add in the writing. But with the new testing now, an assessment test, the Smarter Balance, the focus is argumentative, right, being able to cite sources and things of that nature. So what's been spoken about is very good, that speaks to that, that gets the kids to first engage in what they like to use, and then you have to drive that to now a depth of knowledge, to go from a DOK level one, just a basic what they're used to answering, now to critical and analytical thinking and discussions. And our high schools do have debate. We do have classes where they debate. Inglewood High School has a criminal justice program that just started this year, and that's a lot of debate going on, yeah, and a lot of reading. And it's new, so it's building, but at least we do have it there and it's established. But it's going to take a lot. And I wish we did have the technology that you're talking about, but that's one of our problems in Inglewood,
yeah,
is the technology piece.
Yeah.
But we're working on it.
Any other questions?
Did you have a question, Kenny? Did you have a question? Thank you. Thank you very much. It was a pleasure being here.
Sure.